This episode is brought to you by Affinity, a relationship intelligence platform that empowers teams to find, manage, and close high-quality deals. Find out why firms like Octopus Ventures, Dawn, and First Minute Capital choose Affinity at affinity.co. Networks are everything. Don't forget to mention you're a friend of Venture Europe when you chat to the team.
What's up, guys and gals? Welcome to a new episode of Venture Europe with me, Colleen Fabry. Our guest today is Sabina Wiesander, partner at Creandum. Creandum is a venture capital advisory firm with offices in Stockholm, San Francisco, London, and Berlin, funding early stage entrepreneurs from a 450 million euro fund. They have an exceptional track record, having previously invested in Spotify, Klarna, Trade Republic, Kahoot, and Bolt, just to name a few. Part of her tenure as an investor at Creandum, Sabina joined the healthcare startup Kry after they invested in the seed round, and she was part of the journey from 20 to 1,000 employees and from 0 to 150 million yearly revenue. In 2016, she rejoined the investment firm as a partner. During this episode, we discuss about her journey with Kry and how that changed her investor mentality to have more empathy towards the entrepreneurs. We discuss about the struggle of finding a balance when having a family, but also a job that you love, and why she's excited about the energy industry. Please enjoy this wonderful, heartfelt, honest conversation with Sabina Wiesander, partner at Creandum.
Woohoo! Yes!
Now I just ruined my hair because of these old school headphones, but good.
You look great.
Sorry about that.
No worries at all. No worries at all. Thank you very much for taking the time and coming over on the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm well. Thanks for having me. I mean, it's a beautiful, sunny and snowy day in Stockholm, and the light is finally returning to the Nordics. So I'm feeling great.
Normally, you should see the sun in my background, but I just had to, you know, put off all the light because I just bought like this purple light just to have a better video. But I definitely agree. It's really nice to see the sun coming out in Stockholm.
Yeah, energizing.
Exactly, exactly. Let's jump right into it. Let's start with the story of you leaving McKinsey and joining Creandum. Do you remember the day you decided that you want to join the VC industry? What was the decision process like?
It was a very intuitive and a decision process driven by, I think, the heart more than the brain, for sure. I had been with McKinsey for, you know, 3-4 years. I had ended up in the San Francisco office after a lot of convincing on my end. And suddenly the illusion had just burst for me. So I'm sure anyone that has worked in a similar environment like McKinsey & Company know how they kind of make you drink the Kool-Aid, how it's almost like a cult, you know, you get fed with the story of how important the firm is and how much impact you have in your role as a consultant. And when that illusion burst for me, you know, I felt like I couldn't stay, you know, a day more. I mean, a colleague that I was, you know, talking about this with, he was giving the analogy of, like, you know, when you work with the companies of yesterday, it's almost like you're just rearranging the rows on Titanic into, you know, tidy rows, but the ship will go down, you know, either way. It doesn't matter how hard you work. And that's just to me. And being in the environment of the Bay Area and San Francisco, you know, the one thing that looked like the companies of tomorrow was, of course, anything in tech. I think, you know, once I made the decision, I spoke to, you know, my mentor on Monday and I left on Friday. You know, I couldn't do a minute more than that.
Oh, wow. And were you always like this, to take the decision based on your heart? Like, how did that happen? Was it like a gradual process?
I'm an engineer and a mathematician. So, I mean, part of me is, you know, very logical, numbers-based. But when it comes to my career, I could never do a good job if I don't have my heart into it. I'm not, you know, I can work really hard, but I really have to believe in it to do it. So I think when it comes to these career decisions, it's always been passion-based for me. And I've been lucky that, you know, it's worked out anyways, and I've had amazing opportunities to pour that passion into great opportunities. But I really admire the people that can say, you know, I'm going to do 2 years here at Goldman Sachs because it will take me to this next level. But that's far away from my personality, unfortunately.
And was it hard to break into VC?
I think it was very serendipitous for me. So I had a clear vision. I wanted to go into tech. I had the sense that, you know, the step that would make it most similar and where I could put the most value of what I learned as a management consultant would be VC. So what I did was actually, I didn't know anyone that worked in VC. So on LinkedIn, I took the advanced search and I looked up all the people in Europe that had the past 5 years transitioned from McKinsey into VC. And at, you know, this was back in 2014. So there wasn't the amount of firms and great people in VC that it is now. It was, you know, way, way smaller. So it was probably a handful of people that I, you know, reached out to cold. And, you know, I was lucky that a couple of them actually came back to me and offered their experience and their support. And one of them was Lasse Pilgaard. He was then an investment manager with Grandom. He's now, I think, the CFO of the large media company, MTG. So he pinged me back and offered me to meet over a coffee. And it turned out that Grandom had been searching for the next investment manager for quite some time without finding the right one. Quite a bit of, you know, good luck and good timing to have me ended up there first time around.
Right person at the right time.
And yeah, and just a little bit of, I guess, naivety or too much, I guess, confidence to just ping people out of the blue and hoping they will get back to you.
What would you do differently today?
I mean, when I've looked at how I've navigated different jobs, I think that's actually one thing I've done well. I think the classic advice you give to younger people is, you know, if you are a very ambitious, smart person, you will always get a job. You just need to figure out, you know, what job you want and what job you can thrive in because you're really interested in it, right? I've kind of had that strategy from the start. I think what I wish I could have realized sooner and that I'm still struggling with, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, is, of course, to find that balance in your life where if you are a person that is, you pour your heart into things, you know, you often end up in a situation where your job consumes a lot of, you know, who you are. So what I'm, you know, what I wish I knew then and what I'm still kind of trying to figure out is how to run it as a marathon and not as a sprint.
Interesting that you mentioned balance. I also know that you have a family, so I might come back, you know, to this part maybe in the closing. Let's get personal. But now let's focus like on the VC journey. How was the first year as a VC like?
When you come into VC, especially having been in a large context like McKinsey, you know, my experience was very much, you know, being thrown into the deep end of the pool. As an investor, I think regardless of seniority and tenure, it's the type of job where you need to, you know, figure it out a lot on your own. Right? No one's going to tell you what to do or how to do it. Luckily, the tech ecosystem, both back then and now, it's a very open, warm community, right? So I always felt very welcome. And I always felt that it's an industry where people are always offering their help. If you just, you know, figure out who to reach out to and how, you can find guidance. But I mean, you are a lot on your own and you need to be comfortable with that.
How did your assessment of founders change during this years?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I'm lucky to be surrounded by a group of people that have, you know, 20 years my experience being investors that I already back in 2015 could start learning from. But I think, you know, the two journeys have been, one is, of course, the weight you put on the founders compared to any of the business metrics when you're an early stage investor. And then I think the second is the value you put into book smartness or intelligence versus other important characteristics of a founder. I think having seen a lot of, you know, the most smart people that I've ever worked with at McKinsey coming out as founders and not at all be as successful as I thought they would be in the new environment, because they're lacking a lot of, you know, the other very important skill sets that you need as a founder. And some founder that might not come across as book smart at all, although I'm sure they are, with the drive and charisma and just a very strong vision, you know, how all of those things are, you know, equally important as just...
And I completely agree with you. I think, like, for me, it was, and even though, like, I was only, like, 2 years in VC, like, in the beginning, it was just to make the difference between a very good salesman and a good founder. Because a good salesman can do a very good job in selling, but then is that necessarily also, like, a good founder?
I think for me, the test I always apply now is, you know, would I come work for this person? Mm-hmm. And if I wouldn't, you know, report to this CEO, I'm not going to put down a term sheet.
That's a good test. And talking about working for a CEO, I know that after you joined Creandum, you guys invested in the seed round in Kry, which is a health tech company here in Stockholm. And then you kind of joined the team and grew with the team for 5 to 6 years. So I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, you guys invested in the seed round in 2016. Then 4 investment rounds later, it's 2021, the company's valued at around $2 billion, and then you kind of joined back in the investment team of Creandum. It sounds like a very exciting ride. Tell me more about the journey with Kry.
No, it was, you know, one of the most exciting company journeys you can be part of course, but also a lot of blood and sweat and tears along the way. I mean, Creandum invested alongside Index and Project A back in 2016. So I had the chance to work with the company from kind of the investor perspective for some time. And I already knew Johannes Schildt, the CEO, and the other founders quite well. And I had been a VC for a couple of years, and I felt that there would always be a limit to how great of an advisor I could be if I hadn't done, you know, a couple of years in the trenches myself. So I had this sense that at some point I will need to find an operational journey to jump on. And here, again, back to kind of being passion driven, I was completely sold on the vision of Kry, you know, the journey to digitalize healthcare that has been so untouched about digital tools, at least at that point. I thought of it as a very exciting societal change. And there was a chance to be part of that journey. So I couldn't really resist. And I joined as, I think my role was director of business operations, you know, very kind of business janitor. So picking up anything that needed to be done on business side, anything from fundraising to, you know, copying keys to the office and anything in between. And then I transitioned into, you know, leading the full commercial side of the company. And I got the chance to see, I think we were less than 20 people when I joined. So seeing the journey from 20 people to almost 1,000 and, you know, going from almost no revenue to, I think, 150 million euro, you know, when I left, I feel very privileged to have gotten the chance to be part of that building story with, you know, so many amazing people that just left, you know, big companies like iSettle and Spotify to join this crazy healthcare journey.
What a wonderful story. And do you have any moments that you remember that had an impact on you, both as a professional, but then also as an investor?
I was, you know, doing this for the first time at Kry, right? So everything was new. And yeah, I think, you know, I've had steep learning curves in most of my jobs, but probably never as there. I think what I take with me as an investor is having seen the process from the other side. I wish all VCs would be forced to run a fundraising process from the founder's perspective, because I think it makes you very humble as an investor in, you know, how you use the operator's time, or how you use the founder's time, and what kind of questions you spend time on with them. So not that long after I joined Cree, we had a fundraising process and we ended up raising from Excel. And even if I would have gone back straight into VC after those, you know, first 6 months and that raise, I think I would have been 100 times better investor, just knowing what it feels like sitting on the other side of the table.
What does it feel like?
I think one of, you know, I think some, you have poured your heart into a business and someone is trying to tear it apart and understand the details of it. And I think it's important to have a lot of respect for how emotional it is, for, you know, how the emotional connection between a founder or a, you know, management team and the company they're working with. I mean, as an investor, you're looking at 10 companies per week. But I mean, as on the operating side, you know, you've picked something and you're doing that, you know, 60, 80 hours a week, and you're pouring your heart and soul into it. So I think it's good to have that perspective with you. You know, a topic of conversation for many investors is, of course, you know, but what about your competitors? You know, what about them? And I mean, as an operator, as a founder, you would never consider, of course, leaving where you are to go to a competitor. I mean, that's not in your mental picture at all. And you have tons of, you know, internal problems and problems with your own business. You're probably way less concerned about competition than your current investor and future investors are. So I think that's, for example, a topic where, you know, you can handle it well, but you can also handle it in a way where the operating team and the founder feels that you're not convinced about this business. You're just shopping around in a pool that looks a little bit interesting to you.
Right. I think both parties can learn from each other. An
For
investor
sure.
can learn, you know, a lot being in the shoes of an entrepreneur. They can learn to have a little bit more empathy, you know, when kind of drilling down, digging into the business. And also I think as an entrepreneur, you can learn a lot by being maybe an investor, because then you have a little bit more of the overview of the market.
Yeah.
And let's change gears and let's focus on Creandum. What is your investment strategy? What do you guys invest in?
So we are what you call an early stage pan-European generalist firm. So meaning we do seed and A, we do it across all of Europe, and we can theoretically do it in any vertical or industry. But that doesn't mean that all of us look at all types of companies. You know, in this day and age, of course, as an investor, you still need to know, focus and, you know, make sure that there are some sectors and verticals that you know really well. Creandum in the past has been very successful in fintech. We've been very successful in B2B SaaS. We've been very successful in mobility, and we're now translating that into, you know, being, you know, using those learnings into going into energy related topics. But in theory, you know, any founder working on an amazing new project with a global potential could be in scope for us.
Got it. And what is a deep dive that you have done recently and gets you excited?
Deep dive I've done recently. We have been spending a lot of time in, you know, what we call the green energy transition. And it's been a sector on the rise for a long time, but of course, recently, extremely accelerated by the energy crisis and the energy prices in Europe. And I think, you know, energy is one of the biggest sectors globally, if you look at GDP, and it stands before this huge shift towards becoming less dependent on fossil fuel. At the same time, we're seeing so many experienced founders from other industries coming in to build things in energy. So, you know, I think that makes me very excited.
Interesting. And how do you look at the value chain? I've been talking with a friend that worked at this energy consultancy company in Norway, and then he told me that you have the downstream and then the upstream, but there may be very few things that you can disrupt in the creation of the energy, but it's more on the side of where the consumption is happening. How do you guys look at it?
Yeah, I mean, it is a complicated topic, but I think you know, we look at the full value chain, all the way from, you know, what's the software that you use for planning offshore wind, to all the way to energy management apps that sits in the hands of the consumers, and anything in between. And then, of course, we are more prone to invest in, you know, digital, you know, or software heavy versus hardware heavy industries. But I mean, we are super proud investors in a company called Tesseract out of London that is kind of, you know, end-to-end green energy company that is, you know, buying up wind and solar production capacity on one end, and at the same time is creating a utility company that is consumer facing. So, you know, that's a company that's spanning almost across the full value chain, right?
What's the number one mistake you see founders do when fundraising?
I think looking 2023 versus, you know, 5-8 years ago, I think one of the biggest shifts in the industry is how experienced founders are when they go out and talking to investors. I think founders are, you know, today they're very skilled in how to run the process. And I think they've also added the big part of the process, which is, you know, you're not only being evaluated, but you are evaluating your investors, because you're going into potentially 10-year plus partnership. So it's, of course, equally important to evaluate from both sides. But we have seen the industry and the market change in the last couple of quarters, where we've gone from really high valuations, really large round sizes in 2020, 2021, and first part of 2022. And now it's a completely new playground. And I think what we see now is, you know, founders not adapting fast enough to this new reality, that they go out with expectations of raising as it was 2021. And then, you know, having to come back to the market a couple of weeks later with a lower number. And I think that's fine. And a good investor should be able to still identify a great company out of that. But I think it, of course, has quite negative signals towards the market when you come back with half the round size you set out to raise a couple of weeks ago.
So it's always better to try to raise less, and then if you see that it's competitive to increase, then try to go in the market and raise more, and then come back and then only raise half a round.
Exactly. I mean, and that's always been the playbook. But I think now, you know, we've seen the, you know, one of the most drastic changes in valuations and round sizes these last, you know, 6-9 months. So I think it's also important to founders that haven't been out raising for the past 12 months, you know, have enough conversations with investors in the market before you put numbers down, just to calibrate your expectations.
And how do you see, because I was talking with an entrepreneur the other day, how do you see this calibration happening? Like, do you see it as a bad sign if an entrepreneur say, hey, I would like to discuss with you about this, but they don't have the full story and they don't know how much they want to raise? Because on on one side you could say, well, like, that means at least you haven't planned your scenarios. You can always have like two scenarios. So I don't know, like, how willing do you think are investors or you to actually just take a talk without the entrepreneur knowing how much they want to raise, at least have some scenarios in their head? Because I guess that's a function of costs and their plans.
Yeah. I'm sure it varies from investor to investor how much of, you know, final presentation versus an open dialogue they want. I mean, I've been on that side of the table planning these scenarios and running these models 5 years ahead. So I'm very aware that, you know, they're just models, right?
Yeah.
There's no truth to them before you start executing, and you can make them more aggressive and you can make them less aggressive. And, you know, that's a conversation that you should have with your current investors, if you have any. And I'm very open to have those with companies coming in and raise, right? I think it's hard when you don't know a business at a depth to have a complete open conversation. But I mean, if you are a founder and you look at your business and say, you know, this is the aggressive plan, where I raised 10, and this is the more modest plan where I raised 7, you know, let me hear your thoughts on what you think will create value and how the businesses will be evaluated next time we raise money. I mean, I think that's, you know, a founder will always know their own business better than their investors, regardless of how great investors they have on board. But when it comes to fundraising and setting the company up for success next time they fundraise, you know, that's, you know, the one topic where the investors will always sit with more information. And I think it's, you know, the best possible topic to pull in both current investors, but also future investors into the conversation.
Absolutely. Fully agree with you. Let's change gears here and let's get personal. What was the most challenging period in your career and how did you overcome it?
Good question. I think one of the most challenging periods of my career was during the pandemic, early in the pandemic. But it's also one of the most exciting parts of or phases of my career. It was, you know, as we all know, it kind of came to Europe in February, March of 2020. I was, you know, leading the COVID task force at CRI. So, you know, we're, you know, a big healthcare provider in multiple markets in Europe, and then a big healthcare crisis happens. And then trying to figure out, you know, what role can we play here at the same time that you're, of course, managing, you know, your own personal role in this crisis. I was, you know, 6 months pregnant with my first kid at that point. I had recently gone through, you know, some, you know, quite serious healthcare journey on my own. So trying to navigate, you know, the world in a lot of uncertainty and the business in a lot of uncertainty. I think the, you know, the positive side is, of course, that, you know, when the world is very uncertain and you get to pour, you know, a lot of your hours into being part of solving that, you know, that's very comforting. So the world is trying to figure out how to deal with the pandemic. And as the healthcare provider, you actually have the tools to play your part. So at the same time, I think it was, you know, it was the period at CRI where, you know, we had laser focus when we never shipped so much, you know, product as we done in those kind of first couple of months of the pandemic.
Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. And also you mentioned, you know, having a child and then having a family. And then in the beginning of this episode, you mentioned how you still work on focusing on the balance. What have you learned so far? How do you go about having a sort of balance in your life when you have a job that you love and you want to give it all in?
Yeah, I wish I knew. I wish I had a great reply to that. Yeah, I mean, I'm balancing, you know, wanting to pour everything I have into this job and loving it, and at the same time, you know, being a parent to 2-year-old, and of course also, you know, trying to have a life and be a good friend and all of that, you know, ambitions as you have. You know, it's a marathon theoretically. But I'm just in the time of my life where I actually start to realize that I'm in the type of job where, you know, I'm expected to have this job for decades. You know, that, you know, I'm going into partnership with entrepreneurs that will focus on this businesses for, you know, the next decade, and I can be a good partner. So, you know, this is a good time to, you know, be forced to figure out what's the setup that can make me stay, you know, 10 years in this job or more. I don't know what the answer is, but I think a skill that I'm, you know, focusing a lot on is this switching on and off, right? So when you leave work to go home to a toddler, to have some kind of ritual or trick to kind of get your work brain on hold for a bit, because if you will, you know, if you're trying to answer emails and continue to be on Slack while your kids are around, you know, you will hate your kids because they will make you so unproductive. So trying to figure out how to compartmentalize a little bit more with, you know, shutting the computer, shutting off the notifications on your phone, being a parent for a couple of hours, and then being fully back, you know, once they're asleep.
Got it. So brutally prioritizing and switching off while when at home. And
exactly.
What is the worst advice you have received?
Oh, the worst advice. That's a good one. I think people that are not in the same camp as I when it comes to making life and career decisions with their heart, but that are a bit more pragmatic. I think a person that I know both from work and personally have told me that to kind of, you know, be a bit more strategic and stick it out, you know, pick a job to be strategic about your next steps. And, you know, luckily I haven't followed that advice and I don't think I ever could. I think for some people that works out fantastically. You know, they spend a couple of years somewhere where they do a good job, but they don't love it. And that takes them to a place in their career where they do love it. I'm just, you know, it just goes so against my nature that I would never be successful doing that.
And how does it feel to work with someone in the team that is in the Midas list? Does it feel anxious, exciting, pressure?
I mean, when I look at my colleagues, you know, I see them as my partners. I see them as, you know, mentors I can learn from, and I see them as my friends. I don't necessarily, you know, walk around identifying them as, you know, people on the Midas list. And of course, it's easy when you get to know people on a personal level to remember how tremendously, tremendously successful they are. But, you know, I see every day how much I can learn from, you know, some of the more senior partners around me. And I'm just super, super grateful that, you know, they are around to share these learnings. And at the same time, you know, they're very humble people that, you know, you almost tend to forget what amazing careers they have, you know.
And if Sabina from 10 years ago would listen to this episode, what would you tell her?
I think it comes back to this piece around trying to figure out how to make it doable over a long time. I've always, you know, I've always treated it as a sprint. And I think, you know, at some point, you got to realize that, you know, you can't just push yet another year. You know, this is life. It's happening right in front of you as you're trying to, you know, figure out how to get everything done. But I think the earlier you realize that, you know, this is it, try to find a way to make it sustainable.
Sabina, if you're listening to this, make it sustainable.
Easier said than done.
Easier said than done. Always, right? Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Exactly.
Thank you very much for taking the time, Sabina. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me.